Welcome to the Deep Dive. We've got a really remarkable stack of sources this week, and they're guiding us into, well, a pretty profound methodological discussion. It's all centered on Matthew Qualas's work, The Practical Origins of Ideas, Genealogy as Conceptual Reverse Engineering.
Yeah, and this is a deep dive that's really, you know, tailored for those of you who think seriously about philosophical methodology.
Right.
Our mission today is to unpack this powerful framework, this this idea of turning our philosophical inquiry backward in a way.
Backward how?
To show exactly why and how creatures like us humans came to think in these grand abstract terms that, you know, really shape our reality.
So we're talking about things like truth, justice, knowledge.
Exactly. And we're moving beyond just tracking the history of a word. We're getting into the deep mechanics of what you might call conceptual necessity.
Okay, so the foundational challenge in philosophy, historically, has always been centered on what we call the Socratic question, right? What is X?
Right. What is justice? What is knowledge? For millennia, philosophers have tried to aim straight at the essence of these ideas.
And the belief was that if you could just capture that essence, you could define it perfectly.
Then the function and the value of the concept would just sort of naturally follow from that definition.
But as you know, that Socratic path, for all its nobility, it often leads to this incredible philosophical gridlock.
It really does. I mean, just think about epistemology, the whole field.
The attempts to define knowledge as what justified true belief?
A stable set of necessary and sufficient conditions.
Yeah.
And then along come these counterexamples, like the Gettier problem.
And the whole thing just falls apart.
The consensus just evaporates. And we end up in these perpetual debates where, you know, clarity feels fragile, momentary, if it even arrives at all.
And Qualas's work, the sources we have, they suggest that this pattern of endless unresolved debate might actually be a signal.
A signal that we're pointed in the wrong direction.
That our whole approach is maybe fundamentally misdirected. Pierce once described ideas as vagabond thoughts that tramp the public highways without any human habitation.
I love that quote. It's like, they exist, but we've disconnected them from their purpose. We're studying them in vacuo.
In a vacuum.
Precisely. In isolation from the context of, you know, purpose of human action. It's kind of like studying a really complex tool without any reference to the task it was designed to accomplish.
So ideas are at home when they're doing something for us.
They're in their element when they serve a function that's rooted in contingent facts about us, our psychology, our needs, our environment.
And if you abstract all that away,
then you risk rendering the concepts totally sterile, like that other great quote from the book, studying a shoal of beached fish.
So the proposal is to turn the whole order of explanation around, instead of starting with what is X, trying to nail down that perfect definition.
We shift to what the book calls the pragmatic question.
Which is?
Why would creatures like us be driven to develop the idea of X?
Ah, okay. So it's a why question, not a what question.
It's a complete reversal. It's got this Voltairean spirit to it, you know? If a concept like justice or truth didn't exist, we would have had to invent it.
Not out of some abstract intellectual curiosity.
No, not at all. Out of basic practical need.
And this ties directly into Nietzsche, doesn't it? He was always wondering why these highest concepts, these, what did he call them? Last wisps of smoke at the evaporating end of reality, why they became so crucially important to us.
Yeah.
And that's the core thesis. Ideas persist because they fill a necessary and often self-effacing practical need. They earn their keep, so to speak.
So this method, pragmatic genealogy, it's the key to unlocking that mystery. It's like an intellectual shortcut to understanding why our whole conceptual world looks the way it does.
Okay, let's really unpack this methodology. The book frames it as conceptual reverse engineering, which is just a brilliant metaphor. It immediately positions the philosopher as like a detective.
A detective, yeah, or an engineer. It's a backward-looking enterprise.
What do you mean by that?
Well, think about physical engineering. If you find a complex machine, but you don't have the blueprints, what do?
You take it apart.
You disassemble it. You work backward from the finished product to figure out its function. And in doing that, you often find it does things you never would have guessed, functions that were unbeknownst to us.
So we're doing that with concepts. We start with a practice, say, our whole system of making and keeping promises.
And we work backward from that existing practice to figure out the practical problem it was designed to solve.
And this is so important because it's the exact opposite of conceptual engineering.
Right, which is the more popular project these days. Conceptual engineering is forward-looking.
It starts with a goal. We need a concept to do X more efficiently.
And then you actively design or refine a concept to achieve it. So the reverse engineering part is the foundation for that. You have to know what something does before you can try to improve it.
So it's a safeguard. Before you go tinkering with a concept like money or justice, you need a comprehensive map of all the things it's currently doing for us.
A multiplicity of functions, many of them hidden. It alerts you to what you stand to lose if you fix a concept based on just one perceived flaw.
Okay, let's spend a second on the explanandum. What exactly is being explained here? Because for any students or researchers listening, this distinction is absolutely vital.
It really is. We are not trying to explain, say, the origin of the word justice.
Or how a specific child learns what justice means in their community.
No. The explanandum is the communal practice of living by the idea.
What does that mean, living by it?
Think of the difference between an anthropologist studying a cultural ritual and an actual participant in that ritual.
Okay.
The anthropologist has a disengaged understanding. They know the rules, the vocabulary. But the participant engages in the practice. They are responsive to the reasons that the idea generates in their own life.
They feel its pull.
Exactly. So we're explaining why that practice of feeling its pull exists and persists in the community in the first place. Why people remain committed to its standards.
Which brings us to a problem the philosopher Jane Heal raised, the persistence problem. It sounds technical, but it's really intuitive.
It is. The question is, why do we use just these concepts? I mean, our brains have finite resources, right?
Sure.
And the world is immensely rich. There are countless features we could track. So why did these specific, often really fuzzy, abstract notions like reason or knowledge take hold over all the other possibilities?
And you can't just say, well, the concept of knowledge persists because it helps us form true beliefs about knowledge.
That's completely circular. It doesn't answer the real question, which is about worthwhileness. Why isn't this whole abstract conceptual layer just, as Heal puts it, idle grandiloquence?
It has to be doing real work for us.
It has to fill a need that simpler, purely descriptive concepts just can't.
And this is where the method of pragmatic genealogy comes in, because it defines success not through some universal law, but through model building.
Right. To find these practical origins, it often starts from a hypothetical, a fictional state of nature.
And we really need to emphasize that this is a huge methodological shift, to see philosophy as model building.
It is. We are not trying to formulate these ironclad, necessitated universal generalizations that have to hold true in all possible worlds. We're building models to help explain the observable conceptual practices of human beings.
Which completely changes how you judge success, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
If you accept this, then isolated counterexamples, they lose their traditional philosophical power. Like, let's go back to the Gettier problems in epistemology.
A perfect case. For decades, philosophers have been trying to build a definition of knowledge that can withstand every single clever counterexample anyone can dream up.
But in science or economics, they don't operate that way.
Not at all. An economist builds a model of market behavior. If they find one weird edge case in a remote village that contradicts the prediction, they don't just throw the whole model in the trash.
Right. They refine it.
They refine it. And the source mentioned an economist who said Gettier examples would never even get published in an economics journal.
That's a really powerful critique of the impossibly high bar that philosophy often sets for itself.
It is. The goal should be to build a better model, one that improves on the last one, keeps the old explanatory successes, and adds new ones. Not one that achieves this kind of universal law-like certainty.
So the fictional state of nature isn't a historical claim about what really happened.
No, it's an idealized simplification, a thought experiment. We're using counterfactual thinking to see how a practice, like truthfulness or justice, could only be stabilized by inventing the very conceptual tools we use today.
It's what Wittgenstein was looking for, right? These intermediate links to produce a surveyable representation, an übersichtliche Darstellung.
Exactly. It helps us organize and understand these incredibly complex practices without having to believe they literally unfolded that way in history. It's a lot like Goethe's method for understanding plants by tracing their development through idealized forms.
Okay, let's dig into the actual virtues of this reverse engineering approach. The source lays out 7 key benefits that make this function-first framework, well, better than traditional conceptual analysis.
Yeah, and we should probably go through these carefully, not just rattle them off a list.
Agreed. So the first one is its tolerance for diversity.
This is a big one. Traditional conceptual analysis demands strict, necessary, and sufficient conditions. The moment a counterexample pops up,
the whole definition fails.
It fails. But reverse engineering is different. It says, look, if the core function is, say, coordinating action, then that function can be served by various different conceptual tools in different contexts.
So it's much more tolerant of exceptions. It actually captures the real-world messiness that frustrates those attempts at strict definition.
Exactly. You might have a slightly different concept of truth in a lab setting versus, you know, a personal relationship. But reverse engineering would show that both concepts still serve that bigger function of reliable information pooling.
And that leads right into the second virtue. It makes explanatory use of typical conditions.
Right. Our concepts often reflect properties that are typically worth tracking, not universally required. If the core function of a concept is fulfilled 90% of the time under normal conditions, the concept is doing its job.
Whereas traditional analysis demanded that it track the essential property 100% of the time, which is an impossible standard.
An impossible standard for most of our important concepts.
Okay, virtue three, the power for imposing order. How does this help simplify a really messy conceptual landscape?
It gives you a kind of functional hierarchy. It identifies the basic forms of a concept as being explanatorily fundamental.
And then everything else.
All the immense diversity you see in practice that can be seen as elaborations or derivatives of those core functional foundations.
So if the core function of justice is, say, stabilizing property,
then all the later developments, criminal law, ideas about fairness, can be ordered as necessary extensions of that basic stabilizing function. It gives you a clear structure.
The fourth one is really appealing, dissolving debates. We see these endless philosophical battles where two sides are arguing over the true definition of freedom, for example.
And they assume only one can be right.
Yeah.
Reverse engineering offers a way out. If you look at the function being served, you might discover that both competing analyses are actually just complementary descriptions of different features that are both required to fulfill the same overarching purpose.
So one theory might be describing the subjective feeling of freedom, while the other is describing the objective social conditions needed for that feeling to be meaningful.
Exactly. And the mistake was ever thinking you had to choose between them. They're both describing crucial parts of the same functional system.
Okay, the fifth virtue is a huge one for any philosopher with a naturalistic worldview. The demystifying role. Because concepts like the intrinsic value of truth or moral duty, they can feel a bit spooky, right? Like they're floating in some metaphysical realm.
And that makes naturalists very uncomfortable. But this method brings them right back down to earth. By showing that these lofty-sounding ideas aren't some kind of metaphysical fetish, they're firmly rooted in very real human needs and concerns. The need for coordination, stability, self-protection. It replaces the mystery with practical necessity.
And that grounding in human reality leads to number six, achieving a holistic understanding.
Yeah, this is a very Wittgensteinian insight. The method situates concepts pragmatically. It relates them not just to a definition, but to this whole network of contingent facts about their users and their circumstances.
So you understand a concept not just by looking it up in a dictionary, but by understanding the whole social, psychological, and historical world that gave it a point in the first place.
You get the full picture.
Then finally, number seven loops back to our earlier point. It guides conceptual engineering responsibly.
It provides that comprehensive checklist of functions. I mean, if you try to engineer a new concept of money that's purely digital and stateless, reverse engineering reminds you that, hey, physical currency often serves this crucial self-effacing function of being a reliable store of value for people completely outside the digital banking system.
And if you ignore that function, you could end up disenfranchising huge numbers of people.
Precisely. It protects us by making sure we understand everything a concept is doing before we try to fix it.
So that's the general approach. But now we need to get to the three benefits that are unique to the full pragmatic genealogy, the method that uses those dynamic state of nature models.
Right. And the first one is the most philosophically difficult, but also maybe the most important. It's the power for explanation without reduction.
We have to slow down here. This is the big one.
It is.
Yeah.
Because any naturalistic explanation, any account that roots high ideas and low needs, always faces this criticism that it's reductive.
That it's explaining away the higher thing of like intrinsic moral value as being nothing but the lower thing, like selfish calculation.
Yeah, the classic nothing buttery.
So let me put the challenge to you directly. If you show me that the intrinsic value of truth only emerged because purely instrumental, selfish thinking was unstable, haven't you diminished it? Doesn't knowing how the sausage is made make it taste less like a virtue and more like just practical necessity?
That is the perfect challenge, and it gets right to the heart of the argument. The genealogy avoids reduction because it demonstrates the instrumental inadequacy of purely instrumental thought.
The what?
The instrumental inadequacy. It doesn't deny the intrinsic value. It explains why the intrinsic value had to emerge as a necessary conceptual adaptation. The simpler reductive picture just didn't work.
Walk us through that again, because this is the linchpin.
Okay, so the genealogist starts by building a model where those reductive fears are realized. They put you in a state of nature where agents treat truth as merely instrumental. They only tell the truth when it directly helps them, right now.
Okay, a world of pure opportunists.
Exactly. And then the genealogy shows why that practice is inherently unstable. The free rider problem kicks in, or it just becomes too cognitively demanding to constantly calculate the utility of every single statement. The system breaks down.
Ah, so the reductive, purely instrumental concept fails to solve the very practical problem it was invented for.
Precisely. That failure forces the community to develop a new conceptual practice, namely, valuing truth non-instrumentally for its own sake in order to stabilize the social practice they need.
It's the instrumental reasons for the de-instrumentalization of thought.
That's the phrase. Practical considerations themselves demand that our concepts grow beyond pure instrumentality just to survive and function properly in a messy human world.
So the genealogy shows why the reductive picture, that truth is just convenience, is itself practically inadequate. And by showing its failure, the genealogist actually preserves our right to talk about truth and justice as genuinely non-instrumental values.
Yes. Now, the second unique benefit is that genealogy is not normatively inert. It profoundly affects the space of reasons. It can strengthen or weaken our confidence in our ideas.
Bernard Williams was big on this dual power, right?
He was.
So how does it strengthen our confidence? How does it vindicate a concept?
A genealogy can be vindicatory by showing that an idea, even though it's historically contingent, is stable under reflection and necessary for basic human flourishing.
So if you're worried that justice is just some arbitrary fiction,
Hume's genealogy, which we'll get to, vindicates it by rooting it firmly in the necessary structural features of human interaction. Its negative vindication, showing there was no radical self-deception in its origins, and its naturalistic vindication, rooting it in robust human needs.
But the flip side is just as important. Even a vindicatory genealogy can give you grounds for subversion or critique.
That's the critical edge. By revealing the specific needs and the limited circumstances a concept was invented to solve, you gain the ability to spot when that concept is being overextended.
When it becomes a hypertrophic virtue.
A good thing taken too far,
yeah.
Pushed beyond its useful domain. You can identify the practical limits of an idea, even when you accept as necessary.
And the third benefit ties back to our earlier discussion. It enables responsible conceptual engineering.
Right. Because when we try to fix a concept, we're usually just focused on its most obvious flaws.
Sure.
But the genealogy gives you this multi-layered, comprehensive view of all the functions the concept performs, many of them unbeknownst to us. It ensures that before you throw out the conceptual baby that seems flawed, you understand all the vital, self-effacing bathwater it was holding.
Okay, to really see the power of this framework, we have to look at the classic examples. These genealogies treat ideas as remedies to specific practical inconveniences. Let's start with Hume's genealogy of justice.
Right, an artificial virtue, as he called it, that arose from sheer necessity.
Hume's goal was to show how the moral approval of justice could arise without just assuming people already had a moral sense.
He needed to find an original non-moral motive for people to follow the rules of equity.
And to do that, he constructs this abstract model of a state of nature, and it's defined by three crucial contingent facts. These are the engines of his model.
Exactly. First, the facts of human psychology. We're selfish. But we do have some limited generosity, mostly for family and close friends.
Okay.
Second, the fact of external goods, the things we want, like food and property, are scarce. And third, the fact of transferability. Those scarce goods are easily taken from one person by another.
And that's the recipe for conflict.
Constant conflict. Those three things together, limited resources, limited compassion, and the ease of theft, create the primary social problem. Instability.
So since no passion, not even benevolence, is strong enough to control our self-interest, Hume argues self-interest has to be redirect it.
Right. And he says the solution can't be natural morality because the need for justice only even makes sense after you have concepts like society and property.
Which leads to his instrumental solution.
The instrumental solution is that coordination arises through a convention. People just gradually realize that mutual restraint serves their own long-term self-interest better than perpetual violence.
It's not a formal promise. It's like his famous analogy of two men rowing a boat together.
Or how languages get established. No one signs a contract. It's just repeated experience of the inconvenience of not cooperating.
So this provides the very first reason to act, the instrumental reason to be just. It's in my interest to leave your stuff alone as long as you leave my stuff alone.
Yes. And this is how he avoids what the source calls circular intellectualism.
What's that?
Well, traditional accounts of justice, Hume thought, just presuppose that people were already motivated by a sense of duty or obligation.
They started with the moral idea already in place.
They did. Hume's solution, the convention, avoids that circularity. It shows that the shared need is enough to get the whole practice off the ground, even if the people involved don't yet have a full moral understanding of what they're doing.
But as we talked about before, this purely instrumental, conditional reason is unstable. It's way too vulnerable to the free rider problem.
Especially in large societies, right? It's not enough. So you need the second stage, de-instrumentalization, the emergence of the virtue of justice.
And this is where he brings in the psychological mechanism of sympathy.
Our capacity to share the feelings of others, even strangers we've never met.
So when we just reflect on how beneficial justice is for society as a whole, even if it's annoying for me personally right now, sympathy lets us feel the pleasure of that stability that everyone else is experiencing.
And that feeling of pleasure, that resonance, is the moral sentiment, according to Hume.
Mm-hmm.
And just like that, justice is moralized. It goes from being merely a convenient rule to being a morally approved virtue, which makes the whole practice stable.
The payoff here is huge. Hume's genealogy is highly vindicatory.
Very much so. It's negative vindication. There was no grand deception in its origin. And it's naturalistic vindication because it's rooted in these incredibly robust structural needs.
It shows why the core idea of justice shouldn't be expected to vary that much across different cultures.
It's held in place by what we call structural needs. These second-order needs, like the need to avoid conflict over transferable goods. They're just counterfactually necessary for almost any human society you can imagine.
Okay, now let's pivot to Nietzsche's genealogy of truthfulness. He uses a similar kind of pragmatic model, but he's aiming for a much more critical outcome.
Oh, absolutely. He's not trying to vindicate things in the Humean sense. Nietzsche famously accused philosophers of suffering from a lack of historical sense.
He called it Egyptianism.
Yeah, this desire to mummify concepts, to treat them as these eternal, unchanging essences, when really they're just mutable, time-bound tools. He wanted a genetic history of thought to show that even our highest concepts are inspired by our need.
So his genealogy of truthfulness is framed as a why-ever explanation. We can argue forever about what truth is, but why are we so morally obsessed with truthfulness?
And he starts in a similar place, a primitive, bellicose state of nature where deception is the norm, but it's also very costly.
And from that practical problem, two forms of proto-truthfulness emerge, driven by pure self-interest.
First is proto-truth-seeking, which is just prudence. It's about avoiding the bad consequences of being deceived yourself.
And second is proto-truth-telling, which is purely social. You can't have cooperation if everyone is lying all the time. So society imposes a duty to tell the truth, usually through the threat of being cast out.
Right. So you have this powerful prudential reason to conform. But now comes the crucial step, the thing that turns a mere habit into a virtue, forgetting the original function.
Generations go by and people just start being truthful in accordance with centuries-old habits.
They lose the conscious connection to the original selfish function. And that forgetting is what allows truthfulness to emancipate itself from pure instrumentality.
This is where we have to be really clear about that specific German vocabulary he uses. The shift from Sitte to Sittlichkeit.
Yes. Sitte is just custom, habit, tradition. It's the ingrained, unconscious way a society acts. But Sittlichkeit is morality, virtue, the conscious, principled adherence to a moral rule.
And Nietzsche's argument is that the original function, the Sitte, is forgotten, and this leads to the recoining of habit as virtue.
He calls it a fine old age-old piece of counterfeiting. The virtue is born from the forgetting of its merely convenient origin.
And this forgetting leads to the critical climax of the story, hypertrophy.
The virtue gets inflated. It becomes an unconditional, overriding reason truth at any price. And this is where it becomes a dysfunctional excess.
Captured in that devastating motto, fiat veritas peri ap vita.
Let truth prevail, though life perish. Nietzsche says this exaggerated moral impulse turns an idea that was originally life-promoting, you know, enabled cooperation, into something life-denying. He argues there's no pre-established harmony between the furthering of truth and the well-being of humanity.
So Nietzsche's method is this incredible double-edged sword. It's vindicatory in a minimal sense. It shows you need some truthfulness for society to even exist.
But it's also deeply critical. It gives you the practical criteria to identify when that concept's scope has become a dysfunctional hypertrophy. It's the pragmatic origin story that allows you to see its practical limits.
Okay, so if reverse engineering is mostly backward-looking, we need to see now how it helps guide the forward-looking project of conceptual engineering. How does it give us the tools for conceptual repair?
Miranda Fricker's work on testimonial justice is a fantastic modern example of what you could call an ameliorative genealogy.
Ameliorative, meaning it's aimed at improvement.
Exactly. She uses the state of nature model to forge an on-the-ground tool of critical understanding.
So how does she set up that functional model?
She introduces a model of what she calls the epistemic division of labor.
Okay.
The basic idea is that we all have to rely on other people for information. No one can know everything on their own. For the system to work well, our methods of information pooling need to be efficient and reliable.
But prejudice gets in the way.
Prejudice? Discounting someone's credibility based on their identity is a distorting influence. It gums up the works. It undermines the entire system of cooperation.
So the virtue of testimonial justice, which is the effort to actively counteract prejudice in your credibility judgments, it isn't just some nice ethical bonus.
It becomes a practical, functional necessity that's baked into our most basic epistemic needs.
Right.
Her genealogy shows that we need the virtue of testimonial justice simply to maximize our collective epistemic gains. And that provides what's called a pro tenno reason, a reason that holds unless it's overridden, to cultivate that virtue.
And that reason appeals even to someone who isn't moved by purely moral arguments. It's just a matter of practical efficiency.
Precisely. It allows her to identify testimonial injustice as this utterly basic form of epistemic injustice because it attacked the very mechanism we all need to thrive.
And this idea of necessity brings us back to Bernard Williams and his vindication of intrinsic value through self-effacing functionality.
Right. Williams famously argued that for a liberal society to function, we need to treat truthfulness as an intrinsic good, even if we know it has functional origins.
And he formalized this with two conditions.
The first is the practical necessity condition, or PN. We need to treat X, in this case, truthfulness, as intrinsically good to stabilize the social practice.
And the second?
The sense-making condition, or SM. We have to be able to coherently treat X as intrinsically good. It has to make sense to us conceptually and emotionally.
And the genealogy fulfills both of those conditions.
It does. It proves PN by showing that the purely reductive instrumental approach is inadequate. And it fulfills SM because that mechanism of forgetting allows a genuine internal appreciation and moral sentiment to emerge over time.
And that's really the key to Williams' whole anti-Rotian stance.
Absolutely. He totally accepted that our concepts are contingent on human needs, but he rejected the Rotian conclusion that this makes them all rationally arbitrary. That irony.
Instead of just saying it's all contingent, Williams asks,
what are these ideas contingent upon? And the answer is these deep structural needs, the need to avoid conflict, the need for reliable information, that are just incredibly robust across almost any conceivable human society. And that understanding leads to reflective stability, not irony.
But we have to address the elephant in the room. The single biggest objection to any origins-based philosophy, the genetic fallacy. Doesn't basing the justification of an idea on its origins automatically commit this fallacy?
It's the crucial challenge, and the genealogist has a very clear defense. The genetic fallacy, properly understood, says you can't infer justification from irrelevant information about genesis.
For example?
Arguing that geometry is flawed because its inventor, Pythagoras, held some really eccentric personal beliefs. That would be a genetic fallacy. His personal life is totally irrelevant to the truth of the Pythagorean theorem.
But the genealogist is arguing that the formation processes are not irrelevant. They're actually reason-giving.
Exactly. Because they concern the concept's direct relationship to human needs and problems, which is absolutely relevant to its justification. The origin story isn't some random anecdote. It is the demonstration of how the concepts solve the necessary problem for us.
So how does genealogy sidestep the fallacy then?
Well, there are two ways. First, some of our practices are genetically justified. Their authority is explicitly based on their formation, like in law or a religious ritual. If a genealogy shows the practice's own story about its origins is false, then it directly subverts its authority. No fallacy there.
Okay, but what about the more general cases, like justice or truth?
In those cases, genealogies are yielding justifications. The formation process provides an abductive argument reasoning to the best explanation. The concept persists because it's the result of a vindicatory formation process that successfully solves a deep structural problem that we continue to face today.
So it's not about the past for the past's sake. It's about how the past reveals a present function.
Precisely. And this non-fallacious approach lets the genealogist carve out this really vital middle ground. They aren't searching for some absolute, timeless, universal standard, a search that usually just ends in frustration and skepticism.
But they're also not just complacent conservatives who accept ideas simply because they're old.
No. Instead, pragmatic genealogy asks, what are these ideas contingent upon? And by understanding that deep contingency, that history made our conceptual world ours, we're freed from that impossible search for an absolute point of view. And instead, we gain reflective stability in the face of that contingency. Understanding why we have the need actually strengthens our confidence in the conceptual tool we invented to meet it. #outro.
So this has been a really deep dive into the practical origins of ideas, and it really forces you to reconsider the whole philosophical enterprise.
It does.
Pragmatic genealogy is just an incredibly powerful tool that moves the whole inquiry beyond that static, what is X, to the dynamic explanatory question, why did we invent X?
And by building these dynamic idealized models, these states of nature, we reveal these crucial, often hidden functions. We can trace the complex paths of de-instrumentalization.
And the framework, it successfully gives us explanation without reduction and facilitates responsible conceptual change.
It really transforms our understanding of concepts. They stop being these ethereal, fragile things and become what they are, highly effective, robust tools that are rooted in necessity.
The ultimate synthesis here seems to be that philosophy, if it wants to pursue true self-understanding, it just can't be too pure.
No, it has to integrate the findings of the human sciences, psychology, sociology, history, to understand the contingent facts and structural needs that form our conceptual foundations. And these dynamic models of pragmatic genealogy, they're the receptacles that allow that integration to happen without the discipline losing its core identity.
And this method goes way beyond just abstract concepts like truth or justice. It's vital for understanding our political and social life.
It really is. So consider the concept of the separation of powers,
yeah.
Legislative, executive, judicial. We often treat this as a universal ideal, but it's profoundly rooted in a very specific, modern, local need. The need to negotiate the fundamental tension between individual and collective self-determination.
Right. It's a concept designed to manage conflicts in a very specific kind of society, a modern liberal one.
Exactly. So here's the final provocative thought for you to mull over. Given that the problem that the separation of power solves is local to modern liberal societies, and given that global institutions are always trying to export this model, how might a pragmatic genealogy, one that's tailored to this specific historical context, both vindicate this concept against the suspicion that it's just an outdated relic, and this is the crucial part, guide its responsible application at the international level?
Where the concepts of legitimacy and self-determination face entirely new structural needs and pressures.
Pressures the original model was never designed to solve. At the end of the day, understanding the origins of the tool is the only way to responsibly know when and how to rebuild it for a new job.